This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Finance Advisory are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Everybody, this is Richard Martin, back with the Richard Martin wake-up call. Sorry not to have been with you last night. As I explained, I did have a prior engagement which was organized before I knew I was to be on the series of call-in shows on a Sunday night. So I wasn't able to cancel it, so thereby no show from me. Well, I thought I would start today with some vignette about the grim economic environment. It seems to be very necessary given the amount of bullishness in the markets and on the economy to remind you that things really not looking up. There is no recovery such as you're being led to believe. There's 101,000 of these things happening, but just to give you some idea, and I get this from this Morris County Star Ledger, entitled Morris County Shelters See Growing Number of White-Collar Professionals Becoming Homeless. Shelter workers and others who work with the homeless in Morris County say they are seeing a new group of people who have lost their homes, white-collar professionals. Many of these newly homeless professionals are staying at county shelters, officials said. Well, another one from the Associated Press entitled Jobless Professionals Vie for Holiday Sales Work. And I quote, jobless professionals compete out of desperation for temporary holiday season sales jobs. Retailers report a surge in applications this year from professionals who had never applied for such jobs before. Quote, you'll find Wall Street stockbrokers and small business owners trying to find temporary retail jobs during the holidays, said Ellen Davis, vice president of the National Retail Federation. The pay is low, the jobs temporary, and the work is hardly equal to their experience or expertise. Yet the nation's unemployment crisis left these people jobless so much longer than they'd expected that many count themselves fortunate to have anything. Well, from KKTV.com comes this, headlined, Police Propose Banning Homeless Camps. Colorado Springs has seen a boom in homeless camps in areas along Interstate 25. Now the police department is proposing an ordinance that would make it illegal for homeless people to camp out on public land. Police say the ban is needed because of safety and sanitary issues associated with these camps. It gets cold, said Randy, a 49-year-old homeless man. Randy has been homeless for the better part of a year. He tries to keep warm with a small fire. He says, it's not always enough to keep comfortable when the temps drop into the teens. It ain't no fun coming out here, said Randy. After losing his job, he lost his apartment and everything else. So he lives along Fountain Creek in a small tent. I'm 50 years old and I ain't afraid to work, said Randy. But just trying to get work, you've got to have a vehicle. I don't have a vehicle. I lost everything I got. Well, next week, the Colorado Springs City Council will review an ordinance that would make it illegal for people to camp on public land and in city parks. The ordinance cites problems with sanitation, open fires, and crime. Well, no prizes for asking the relevant questions there, ladies and gentlemen. The Tribune Review, in an article entitled Recession Trickles Down to Practices as Patients Put Off Treatment, says, A report by the American Dental Association said the migration is taking its toll on thousands of dentists who are wrestling with rising equipment and staffing costs while serving fewer patients. As many as 80% of the nation's 160,000 dentists say the recession forced them to put off buying equipment, delay retirement plans, or lay off staff, according to results of a recent survey by the ADA's Health Policy Resources Center. Revenue fell because patients are going elsewhere for cleanings, root canals, and fillings, or simply aren't seeking treatment because they can't afford it, researchers concluded. Most dentistry is elective, and people are elected to save money wherever they can by not making appointments. Well, finally comes this from the Daily Dish, entitled The View from Your Recession. A reader writes, I work for a small municipality that serves 40,000 people. As our fiscal year restarted in October, we had about 10 jobs open up, ranging from public works, $12 an hour, to policewoman, $42,000 a year, to jailer, $15 an hour, to PD dispatch, $14.50 an hour. These aren't high-paying jobs, though benefits are included. I am here to tell you that I have never, in my 10 years here, seen so many people come in to apply for a job. We are getting all types of people, most of whom I know have a zero chance of getting hired just by the looks of them. I know, a bit judgmental, but believe me, it's that obvious. Every day, HR is processing gobs of applications. A human resources rep just told me they have gotten about 400 applications for the 10 positions that have been open since October the 1st. And 80% of them won't even qualify for consideration based on municipalities' stricter hiring guidelines. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today, one in five Americans is unemployed, underemployed, or just plain out of work. One in nine families can't make the minimum payment on their credit cards. One in eight mortgages is in default or foreclosure. One in eight Americans is on food stamps. More than 120,000 families are filing for bankruptcy every month. The economic crisis has wiped more than $5 trillion from pensions and savings, has left family balance sheets upside down, and threatens to put 10 million homeowners out on the street. Families have survived the ups and downs of economic booms and busts for a long time. But the fall behind during the busts has got worse, while the surge ahead during the booms has stalled out. In the boom of the 1960s, for example, median family income jumped by 33%, adjusted for inflation. But the boom of the 2000s resulted in an almost imperceptible 1.6% increase for the typical family. While Wall Street executives and others who owned lots of stock celebrated how good the recovery was for them, middle-class families were left empty-handed. The crisis facing the middle class started more than a generation ago. Even as productivity rose, the wages of the average fully employed started more than, male must have been flat since the 1970s. But core expenses kept going up. By the early 2000s, families were spending twice as much, adjusted for inflation, on mortgages than they did a generation ago, for a house that was, on average, only 10% bigger and 25 years older. They also had to pay twice as much to hang on to their health insurance. To cope, millions of families put a second parent into the workforce. But higher housing and medical costs, combined with new expenses for childcare, the costs of a second car to get to work, and higher taxes combined to squeeze families even harder. Even with two incomes, they tightened their belts. Families today spend less than they did a generation ago on food, clothing, furniture, appliances, and other flexible purchases, but it hasn't been enough to save them. Today's families have spent all their income, have spent all their savings, and have gone into debt to pay for college, to cover serious medical problems, and just to stay afloat a little while longer. Through it all, families never asked for a handout from anyone, especially Washington. They were left to go on their own, working harder, squeezing nickels and taking care of themselves. But their economic boats have been taking on water for years, and now the crisis has swamped millions of middle-class families. The contrast with the big banks could not be sharper. While the middle class has been caught in an economic vice, the financial industry that was supposed to serve them has prospered at their expense. Consumer banking, selling debt to middle-class families, has been a goldmine. Boring banking has given way to creative banking, and the industry has generated tens of billions of dollars annually in fees made possible by deceptive and dangerous terms buried in the fine print of opaque, incomprehensible, and largely unregulated contracts. And when various forms of this creative banking triggered economic crisis, the banks went to Washington for a handout. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin, the Richard Martin wake-up call, coming to you from ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com in New York City. Our call-in number for your questions is 888-873-4643. Toll-free as it be, I would like to get your questions and calls and feedback, please. Maybe I'm doing a terrible job. Who knows? I will never know if I'm not told. Anyway, listen, please, once again, call in toll-free 888-873-4643. If you really would like to email your questions, that can be done and should be done by emailing me right now at rm@gfawd.com. That is my email address. My email box is wide open, and I can receive emails at an instant and get them back to you. Once more, RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, gfawd.com. Once more, RM at GFAWD. Dot com. And once again, my number, if you would like to call me privately to offer in your questions and your concerns about your personal situations, you may do that by calling me on area code 941-441-1682. That is my direct line to Sarasota, Florida, which will come through to me in Singapore anytime. Please call me on 941-441-1682. All right. We move on next to the latest offering, courtesy of Steve Kruger, which I thought was particularly eloquent. So I shall give it to you straight, ladies and gentlemen, from Steve Kruger, written in yesterday afternoon. Richard, I was born in 1939, so I missed out on all the festivities of the Great Depression and how it affected people. I can, however, tell you how living during the Depression as a youth formed my parents' attitudes and actions into their adult life. My father, an only child born in 1913 to newly arrived Americans of South American Dutch origin. My grandfather was connected to the Transvaal Railroad. They were not wealthy, but they were comfortable. My mother, born in 1915, she was one of four children, also of newly arrived Americans from Hungary. This grandfather was a tool and die maker who could not master English. Unable to communicate, he had to take work as a building superintendent on East 84th Street in New York City. As you might have guessed, my father was less affected by the Depression than my mom. His parents were able to send him to college, and he obtained an engineering degree. Mom, on the other hand, had a hard time growing up during the Depression. Living in a basement on 84th Street, I remember her telling me not a day went past without seeing rats. She would tell me food was scarce and they were always sick. With all this, she managed to get a high school diploma. Mum's only job was that of a sales girl at Saks Fifth Avenue, and she quit after a year because she didn't like the idea of sharing her hard-earned money with the government. She had a talent knitting sweaters and hats. They were works of art. She made a list of contacts from Saks and built it into a business that she made money from for the next 50 years. Everything she did in life was biased towards making money or not spending money. When they married in 1937, they moved to a rent-controlled apartment and stayed till she died in 1995. Richard, as a young boy, I had always thought we were poor. When Christmas came, I would get one toy. Toys were well made back then, like a cast iron truck, a car iron Fifth Avenue double-decker bus, a set of trains, all Christmas presents. Richard, I found out that in the 1980s, she had saved all my toys and sold them to collectors for hundreds. She was hot stuff. Everything was return on investment. Mom also enjoyed playing the piano. Never had a lesson if she could hear it. She could play it. Sort of a Rain Man light. She must have had 8 pianos over the course of her life. She would buy run-down fixer-uppers, play them, refinish them, sell them. Return on investment. In the 1980s, I told Mum that inflation will eat up all her savings, and she told me she has a lot of 10% government bonds, and that inflation will only rob me if I spend my money, and I'm not spending it. My enjoyment is accumulating, not spending. You will be spending it, not me, so you worry about it. She never had a credit card and only had a checking account for the last 10 years of her life. When her life was over, a woman who only had a job for 1 year managed to accumulate over $800,000. Richard, I suspect that a lot of lives will be shaped in this fashion in the coming hard times. I hope we have the character to get through it. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. P.S. I would often kid my mom that she makes Gandhi look like Good Time Charlie. Very nice. Thank you, Steve. Really appreciate your contribution. It's well worth waiting for, as always. All right. What I want to do, in about 10 minutes, we're going to have a promo, so I shall have to sort of stop in the middle of this. But I do want to tell you about why this question of the stimulus really isn't going to help. And I've explained it before, and I always take the opportunity to try to inspire myself to explain it to you in a different way each time. So I'm going to try once again, because it's very important for you to understand why we are in a downward spiral here, and it is deflationary, and nothing that the government can possibly do will help. So let me try to put it this way. For the past 50 years, U.S. debt, both private and public, has grown at an average annual rate of 2.7%, faster than GDP growth. Now think about that. We're talking about debt growing faster than growth, as though, you know, you were for a long period of time to be taking out more debt than you were actually making in money. There is a way to bring this down to an individual experience here. The most recent 15 years, which is to say 1995 to 2010, the trend in annual debt growth has exceeded annual GDP growth by 6%. Now, that's as if you were growing your own personal debts at 6% faster than your income was coming in. You would clearly be having a problem by now if that were to be the case. Debt growth has now pushed the debt to GDP ratio to a new level approaching 300%. And even with that incredible statistic, there are people still saying, so what? And it, even more incredibly, the people who should know better, like Bernanke and Summers and Geithner, are answering, so what? You know, these guys are missing several underlying truths of attempting to stimulate the current U.S. economy with more debt at a time when the current level of debt is at an all-time high. And there are certain there are a number of points I'm going to make to you here. First of all, you have 50 years of overfueling aggregate demand, which means piling more debt on top of the existing high levels of debt will not address the cause of the current global financial crisis. They cannot. You get to the point where debt does not stimulate growth. Debt simply makes people feel better, but gives them nothing more than more money to pay back in the long run at the expense of their future. See, if you add more debt onto the current excessive level of debt, and by the way, public and more recently the 2000 and 2007 private debt growth that fueled an excess of aggregate demand over the past 50 years will not correct the financial dilemma. And in all likelihood, it will make more debt will simply compound the problem. The tradition had it that adding debt would become an accepted practice of growing or stimulating the U.S. GDP growth to reverse the recessions of 1971, 74, 1980, 82, 91, and 2000. And over this period, growth, as usual, caused the debt-to-GDP ratio to climb from 100% in 1971 to 300% by fiscal year 2009. Now, the second point is really a question. How did excessive debt fuel an excess of aggregate demand? Well, most neoclassical economists, again, Bernanke, Summers, Geithner, and most Fed Reserve Board governors, are economically trained to model their thinking that income alone is all that influences aggregate demand. But a few economists who follow Irving Fisher's asset deflation theories of the 1930s argue that aggregate demand is not merely equal to income, but to income plus the change in debt. Now, if that sounds a little arcane, this is how it works. During debt-driven financial stimulations, rising levels of debt propel aggregate demand well above what it would otherwise be due to the income alone contribution to aggregate demand. Increasing levels of normal debt on top of normal income-driven demand leads steady aggregate demand growth to the real economy. But excessive and sustained level of debts on top of normal income drive excesses in both the real economy and asset markets. This is obvious because when you have more debt than can be serviced by the economy per se, that money then becomes excess and has to be applied at some level within the system. And that's why you get artificial bubbles in asset markets in particular, and of course in particular the housing market. And that's why the Federal Reserve is full of blame in this respect, because it could have prevented this happening, and frankly that's why Bernanke should not be re-elected. But I digress. Anyway, the process of adding excessive and levels of debt also adds to the debt burden on the economy, especially when the debt is used to finance speculation on asset prices rather than to expand production. Understand this, ladies and gentlemen, when there is too much money, it is simply not possible to process that money into an economy. It cannot be done. And in the case of the United States, where manufacturing is losing ground to countries with a more economical wage-based system, such as in certain third world countries like China, that just exacerbates the problem. What happens is that increasing debt to finance speculation on assets increases the level of debt without adding to productive capacity, which in turn leads to increasing proportions of the economy needed to service the higher debt level as well. So you add all this debt into an economy which doesn't need or want it, all you are doing is adding more requirement of the regular economy, which has a hard enough time as it is, to pay for all this excess debt, the interest on all this excess debt, which was never needed in the first place. I mean, the incompetence inherent in this kind of thinking is so grotesque that it really calls into question what causes these economists to get employed in their current employment in the first place. If this is really their thinking, it boggles the mind that a country like the United States should accept that these people have jobs and that they should be allowed free rein to control the purse strings of
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Ever wonder why some people have successful lives? Well, let's shrink about this. Hi, I'm Dr. Molly Barrow, author of Matchlines with Singles and the Malia and Teacup Self-Esteem Building Series for Children. Please join me and my guests every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to explore psychological and practical problem solving, from personal issues to world events. You can call in to join the conversation or just enjoy listening. If you're looking for balance in your relationship, career choices, family, and your planet, please join Dr. Molly Barrow and Shrink About This Tuesday at 10 Eastern on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
I'm Steve Barnett. I'm your host for the Paradise Parking Lot, an environmental program on the Progressive Radio Network. We're on the air from 1 to 2 Eastern Time every Wednesday. And we talk about everything environmental. This is an hour show, so there are no sound bites. This is a deep discussion of controversial environmental issues. We provide information. We provide guides to action. We have wonderful guests. For example, we've had John Holdren, President Obama's science advisor. We've had Jaron Lanier, the creator of virtual reality. This program is designed for anyone who's interested in the environment and deepening their understanding of how our planet is changing and what we can do about it.
Hi, I'm Richard Martin of The Wake Up Call. We have a new Sunday evening show called Richard Martin's Discussion Group, which airs at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can access it live on www.progressiveradionetwork.com, or you can listen to it on the archives. This is your show and your opportunity to air your thoughts, questions, and rants on the ills of today's economy. There'll be a theme each week, and I want to hear from you. So please, come on in. Sundays, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and tune in to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.com. You have a date with us. See you then.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
All right, so when the debt to GDP ratio is low, in let's say the 100 to 200% range, the marginal debt burden has little impact on aggregate demand. But whenever the debt to GDP ratio becomes substantial, like it is right now, 300% or more, the changes in debt come to dominate economic performance. So there is a point of diminishing returns. If you use debt intelligently and sensibly, then clearly it can increase the overall wealth of a society. But when you abuse debt, which frankly happens in all democracies at one point in time or another, because the voters discover that by voting for the party that offers them the highest amount of goodies, they can simply gain a free ride for the length of time that the boom lasts until the bust comes, then you have the point of no return, the diminishing returns, where all the debt is just nothing more than a further noose around your neck. And that's, of course, where we are today. So anyway, that was the second point. The third point is the question of whether the global economy can get out of the global financial crisis the same way it got out of prior years' recessions by borrowing. In other words, can we borrow our way out of trouble once more? Well, when debt levels rise too high, the process that Irving Fisher in the 1930s described kicks in, and economic actors go from willingly expanding their debt levels to actively trying to reduce them. The change in debt then becomes negative, subtracting from aggregate demand, and the boom turns into a bust. Not only do the economic actors lose the increased debt effect of stimulating excess GDP, but they also lose the nominal income contribution to GDP through lower wages and higher unemployment. Both of these decreasing contributions deleverage aggregate demand in the short run, as the U.S. is experiencing right now, while the Treasury and the Fed attempt to stop the inevitable debt deflation. Increasing debt, having driven demand excessively higher every year for 50 years by raising GDP faster than normal income contribution to growing GDP, private debt is now falling and reducing aggregate demand. This is what is called deleveraging, and it is now deleveraging at work. And it is the force that governments are trying to resist by boosting their own spending as private spending stagnates. But as the debt is added while GDP stagnates or even falls, only drives the debt to GDP even ever higher, leading to ever higher debt burdens to the U.S. economy. Now, transitioning from a period of decades in which rising debt excessively fueled aggregate demand to one in which the private sector's attempts to reduce debt will subtract from aggregate demand. In fact, normal for the last half century has been an unsustainable growth in debt, which has finally reached a zenith from which it will fall. As it falls by an unwillingness to lend by bankers and to borrow by businesses and households, by deliberate debt reductions, by default and bankruptcy, aggregate demand will be reduced well below aggregate supply. The economy will therefore falter, and only regular, not increasing, government stimuli through debt will revive it. So I hope it's clear why it is that this increased activity on the part of the government is suicidal. It cannot help. We've gone beyond the point where the debt could actively assist in increasing economic well-being. The money is simply too much. It's too much of a good thing. But unfortunately, instead of just existing in a vacuum, that money is scooped up and used to provide stimulus to a system which really doesn't want it or need it. And that's why we're going to have problems, because this isn't just an isolated problem. This is a problem that has to be processed and dealt with, and in this case, by paying all this extra interest on the extra debt which wasn't needed in the first place, all the while with people losing their jobs, losing their source of income, and losing their homes. I mean, this is financial Armageddon of the worst kind, where everything goes wrong together. And ladies and gentlemen, I cannot tell you, I cannot insist too much on how serious this is and what precautions you need to take to guard against it. All right, well, now I want to spend some time talking to you about housing. Housing is, after all, the very backdrop to how we lead our lives. You know, shelter and food is really the basis of life as we know it. I'm just going to show you in a few minutes how the concept of housing has been so terribly abused over the last 20 years. And I'm going to really take California as a case in point, because the housing bubble psychology in California is still, even today, very strong. You know, there are a few people trying to examine why the housing market, with obviously overpriced values, was able to entice many otherwise rational people to take on toxic mortgages like option arms and alt A's. Now, as we've discussed many times on this show, much of the economic crisis stems from greed by the crony banking oligarchs on Wall Street, but also the foot soldiers who pushed the product out onto the street. In the last decade, most buyers and sellers were willing or unwilling participants in speculation. Housing since World War II on a national level has rarely been seen as a hot investment, aside from a few pockets across the country. It is otherwise dry and slow-moving forced savings. And that really is the crux of how housing was viewed. But in California, the gold rush mentality with the glitter of housing fixation shows made buying and flipping homes mainstream. You take, for example, the well-meaning Extreme Home Makeover show, the biggest house that ABC's Extreme Makeover Home Edition ever made over. It was a sprawling four-bedroom starter castle, a three-car garage mahal with a turret and all. Well, that's gone into foreclosure now in the suburbs south of Atlanta. And what's interesting is that in that particular episode of the hyper-benevolent reality show, which first aired in February 2005, it took 1,800 volunteers a week to demolish the house with the overflowing septic tank that belonged to Milton and Patricia Harper of Lake City, Georgia, and then entirely rebuild a new, larger house while the Harpers and their three children went away to Disneyland. When they returned, they had the biggest house on Hayoka Drive with all the appliances and furnishings, plus enough money to pay taxes on it for decades, plus a fund to send their children to college. There have also been extreme foreclosures in Arizona and California. Why? Because people forget the true cost of ownership. The new mega monster homes get assessed at higher tax levels. Energy costs jump, and you have more rooms to furnish. Does the extreme makeover come with a boost in your W-2 income? The show is symbolic of how we view things. Let us do things big, fast, and crazy. Who cares about the longer-term situation? Ironically, the families on the show would be better off if the cost of the upgrades were given to them in cash directly. But not much production value in that. The Wall Street premise was that everyone else would build, manufacture, get dirty, and otherwise do the work, while you were able to get easy money simply by arranging a few papers to get pushed around. Now, for the average man and woman, this is largely a tougher game. Yet Wall Street is still partaking in this casino environment. In a poetic irony of the entire mess, corrupt, toxic banks are now trying to move on the public relations front by paying back billions to the government. This idea is such a preposterous notion. This is like a gambler who is down $20,000 but asks for $40,000, no strings attached, and then makes a bet and wins. He gives you back the $40,000 and walks away with $20,000. The banks are rivaling the corruption of those in the Great Depression. How are banks making their profits? Despite continuing problems with its loans to struggling homeowners and consumers, Bank of America plans to return the $45 billion in aid that it received at the height of the financial panic. A step that only months ago would have been almost unimaginable. But like many other big banks, Bank of America is once again making money, in large part through Wall Street businesses trading stocks and bonds, rather than by making loans. Its recovery, while many ordinary Americans are still struggling, is an important milestone in the government's year-long effort to stabilize the nation's financial industry. This should be obvious. Wall Street is no longer a reflection of the U.S. economy, but of the gambling crony world of Wall Street. You might have noticed that home foreclosures are still near their peaks. Job growth? We're going for 23 straight months of job losses. The longest streak of this kind since the Great Depression. Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, U.S. Bancorp, PNC Financial, American Express, and of course Goldman Sachs, have made up nearly half a trillion in market cap since the lows reached in March. Some are up by 100, 300, even 500%. While these banks made close to $500 billion back in market cap, and this is only eight, so if we include the entire sector, we're talking trillions, we will find that not one net job was added, and the foreclosure rate is still seeing 300,000 filings a month. Glad we're helping out the American public. If you had any doubts where this money is going, this should put that assumption to rest. So what has the bailout accomplished? It allowed banks not to lend money to the public as it was sold to the American people, but to use the taxpayer money to gamble on Wall Street and suddenly recover their lost market cap by pure speculation. The Dow gambler has made a few winning bets. But was that really the purpose? Many American people seem oblivious, or even worse, complacent to this, since the crony banking system is robbing the country blind. Yet this kind of thinking is what infected the population like a financial bubonic plague. People thought that instead of working, they would be able to buy into this paper-pushing culture, and suddenly they too would be on a get-rich-quick path. People didn't deserve a nice home, but a home with granite countertops and flat screens in every room. It wasn't enough to have a good car, but a V10 tank that hauled your kids to soccer practice when it was designed to speed away from lions in the African desert. The 10% automatic stock market dollar cost average, grow your way slowly to millionaire status without working culture is what allowed this to happen. It was a charlatan experiment, and people were entertained by their ringmasters on Wall Street as long as they got a whiff of the scraps. Yet as we are now finding out, the ringmaster let the alligators out on the public while they pick up all the dropped wallets and forgotten purposes while people panic. California was the ultimate shark tank because Wall Street found a willing participant. How else can we explain an absolutely idiotic product like option arms having such wild success? Option arms are zombies spawn of the get-rich infomercial commercials. This loan converted housing into a speculative commodity. Forget about paying principal or even all of your interest. These were short-term products that prayed at the altar of perpetual housing appreciation. It is absolute nonsense. Let us use the peak price in 2007 and take housing prices to their triumphant and stupidly beautiful conclusion. From 2000 to 2007, California housing increased at an annual average rate of approximately 12%. This is just flat out nuts, given that incomes remained stagnant over the same time period. At this point, we would be getting close to a median home price of $800,000. In reality, the median home price in the state is now closer to $250,000. But this is the kind of logic that permeated through the market. The option arm catered to this mentality. Why do you need to make a full payment when you will sell your home in 3 to 5 years for double the price? Plus, that extra cash flow per month can be used to lease a Mercedes so you can go splurge on fancy restaurants with your credit card since you can't even afford it with real money. That was the culture. This arrogance to long-term sustainability. People wanted to live it all up in a mega financial orgy and wake up exhausted from economic drunkenness. Well, today the cold water is being splashed on the public. The psychology is resisting any significant change. There is a group that have adapted and realized things are now different. Another group, I would venture to say, that most of the readers sites which discussed this information were already cautious and they didn't buy into this perma-bull housing nonsense. But another group disdains this austerity and is still patiently waiting for the next turnaround so they can once again ride high on the housing hog. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that boat has long sailed. This was a once-in-a-lifetime bubble, just like the Florida real estate in the 1920s. These people were used to the good life, even though it was debt-induced, and they will have to adjust. But many are swallowing this jagged pill with bitterness. Since for all practical purposes, the government is now mortgage lender of first, middle, and last resort, let us break down the financials of a 30-year fixed mortgage. And one thing you can still hear from people is, well, if you're renting, you're throwing your money away. This is a faulty way of looking things. Most people need to live somewhere, so renting provides a service. You eat at a restaurant, but after the meal, there is no future value. It provides a limited term utility. Housing serves this purpose. But the pressure of being a homeowner by the Madison Avenue marketing machine is deeply ingrained in the psyche of most Americans. Home ownership is a privilege. It is not a right. In the past, you earned this right by proving at the very minimum that you were able to save some money. This helped keep the foreclosure rates steady over decades. From 1979 to 2007, the foreclosure rate never went over 1.5%. We are now over 4.5%. In California, the rate is even higher, with 1 out of 10 mortgage holders in distress. Why did this occur? Over this time, the introduction of the adjustable rate mortgage was the financial daddy of the option arm. The Garn San Germain Depository Institutions Act of 1982, the bill whose full title was An Act to Revitalize the Housing Industry by Strengthening the Financial Stability of Home Mortgage Lending Institutions and Ensuring the Availability of Home Mortgage Loans. This bill was a Reagan administration initiative. The bill is named after its sponsors, Congressman Fernand San Germain, Democrat of Rhode Island, and Senator Jake Garn, Republican of Utah. The bill had broad support in Congress, with co-sponsors including Charles Schumer and Steny Hoyer. The bill passed overwhelmingly by a margin of 272-91 in the House. Then we have the 1999 Graham-Leach-Bliley Act that passed with flying colors and gutted the Glass-Steagall legislation put in during the Great Depression. This was a bipartisan screw over the American people. Option arms were merely the logical conclusion of moronic lending and short-sighted public policy. But now people actually have to look at the actual cost of taking on a 30-year fixed loan. Yes, those boring old-school loans. Since many people are looking to buy something in prime areas of Southern California, good homes are still selling for $500,000 or higher. You know, at the beginning of any fixed mortgage, a large portion of your payment goes to interest. Even with the example of a cheap loan at 5.75%, the bulk of your payment is interest. Your principal and interest payment is $2,917, but it breaks down as follows. Principal, $522. Interest, $2,395. Interest, at a very simplistic level, is the amount of money you pay to rent money. So the notion that renting is throwing money away is wrong on many levels. Also, if you paid for an asset that has fallen by 30, 40, or even 50%, you are now paying rent on a home that isn't even worth the initial balance. With option arms and alt A's, many went zero down, so they are massively underwater. Assuming you take out a $500,000 mortgage, a large percentage of your payment, 82%, is going to interest. So you are slowly chopping away at your balance. In fact, after 10 years, that $500,000 mortgage goes down to $415,000. The mortgage balance doesn't start taking major hits until the last 15 to 20 years. But in California, everything was twisted. People didn't rely on the slow savings of a home, but believed in the perpetual appreciation factor. Without this factor in the equation, we need to rely on more traditional metrics. Of course, some shills think we're going back to the heyday, but that will be challenging with a 23% unemployment and underemployment rate and $20 billion annual budget deficits until 2015. Also, we aren't including taxes and insurance. On a $500,000 mortgage, this will be roughly $520 to $700 a month, depending on your local tax structure. So your total net payment is $2,971, principal and interest, plus $520, taxes and insurance, which equals $3,491. But what about the tax benefits? Ah, yes, another major selling point for the housing clown parade. That above payment, by the way, is a net payment. In other words, you need to pay that out of current income. The after-tax benefit comes at the end of the year or after you adjust your monthly withholdings. One thing people forget about renting is that it is a true reflection of real market price. Rent is paid from monthly income with no tax subsidies. It is a good indicator of economic market health. The fact that in Southern California rents are falling is an indicator that reality-based budgets are getting hit. The current housing numbers are juiced on the following steroids: home buyer tax credit, Fed buying mortgage-backed securities keeping interest rates artificially low, 40-year average at 9%, crashing prices, pent-up fence sitters that can no longer wait and must jump into the shark tank to party. So now why am I actually driving this point home? Well, the answer is because next year is the big wild card for California. The option arms come home to roost in fashion. If anything, why not pull up a chair and watch the action for a year to see how things play out? If you think you're going to miss out on another boom, then you have been brainwashed by all the Wall Street sucker parade. The trend and mean reversion are always present in many economic forces. Housing is not immune to that. Plus, the economy is in the tank. The nation has got its priorities twisted. Don't you think it would have been more prudent to bail out the employment and manufacturing sectors first, before bailing out banks and then the housing industry? If we follow the money, you would think that the government would be happy with all of us just sitting unemployed and subsidized $500,000 homes. But take the example I just cited as well. Many $500,000 homes can be rented for $2,000 a month. So on a net basis, you have $1,491 more in cash flow per month. Forget about the tax breaks for the moment, because you can dump this into a 401k and lower your tax rate as well. So on a yearly basis, you have $17,892 more per month, even with 0%. After 10 years, if you saved the difference, you would have $178,920. Your $500,000 mortgage balance went down by $85,000. But the major speculative point is where housing prices will be in 2020. If we bust in the nature of Japan, it can move sideways for one decade or more. There is no guarantee that housing will always go up. The California median home price is now back to 2002 levels. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the new reality. And by the way, the jobs report last Friday showed that still no jobs have been added. But in the current demented economic structure, that is somehow positive news for Wall Street. Well, this is the reality we're dealing with, and it is a reality, I am afraid, that is going to get worse. Because as long as people are still concerned with how they are going to make up their losses to achieve the levels of 2003, 2004, 2005, they're going to make all the wrong decisions. And whether those decisions include the government, Bernanke, or just the American consumer is quite irrelevant. The fact is, until there is a sea change in attitudes, things are going to get worse. And things are going to get worse because, very simply, the politicians have decided that they must hand out even more goodies in order to get reelected, be that midterm elections in 2010 or the major elections in 3 years' time in 2012. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you, it is time for you to make your ultimate plans to see this depression out in full. And we will be talking about this in detail as time goes by, as we get closer to the ultimate meltdown. We'll talk about what you have to do in order to achieve this. But right now, what I have to do is give you the background information. And there's a tremendous amount of it, and it's very difficult to know exactly what to say, how to position this information for all of you, because I think I have so many listeners with differing levels of knowledge. And I don't always really decide to target the sort of lowest common denominator of knowledge. I try to lift it up a little bit. So I think it's worth your while to listen back into the archives if you have problems with this, because as you know, ladies and gentlemen, I don't pull any punches. I tell you the story as it really is. And it takes me, you know, a while to prepare these talks, because I really want to bring it to you, you know, stone cold sober. Right now, the issue, frankly, is the reappointment of one of the most important and powerful men in the world, namely Ben Bernanke. I mentioned Senator Bunning's speech last week, and I bring you today Bernie Sanders' explanation of his reasons for trying to block Bernanke's reappointment. And it comes in his weekly screed entitled Bernanke Unfiltered. And it comes in three different points here. Where was Bernanke when Wall Street was making all these risky investments and extracting wealth from working and middle-class Americans, resulting in the worst financial meltdown since the Great Depression? Why wasn't he regulating the banking industry and looking out for ordinary Americans? Two, where's the money that the government gave to banks? Senator Sanders asked Chairman Bernanke which institutions received these zero-interest loans for billions and billions of dollars from Bernanke, refused to tell him. This lack of transparency is ridiculous. It's your money. It didn't come from Bernanke's pockets, but U.S. taxpayers. They deserve to know which institutions got the money. Three, where's the regulation since the collapse of the banking system? Why didn't Bernanke limit the amount of interest banks could charge ordinary Americans at, say, 15%, which is what credit unions charge, instead of letting them charge 30%? Why weren't executive compensation packages regulated? Why were the large interests of institutions of finance put before the institutions and interests of ordinary Americans? And finally, why are these too big to fail institutions still around? Why hasn't Bernanke broken them up? If a financial institution is so big it can bring down the economy, then it shouldn't exist. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I suggest very strongly that you Google the words Bernie Sanders petition and please sign it, which is a request not to reappoint Bernanke, and time is running out, so please do that as quickly as possible. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call. Back to you again on Friday. Have a great week. Talk to you then. Bye-bye for now.